Welcome to The Wrap Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an inside look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. And joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, assistant managing editor. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Sharon, how's it going? I'm really excited for this one. I think we have a lot of really good stuff.
Oh, we got a juicy show this week.
Yeah, it's really
juicy,
good.
Juicy. Yes. Lots of controversial stuff to talk about, starting with the Alan V. Farrow docuseries. So if you've been watching this docuseries, which has its finale on Sunday, a lot of people will tell you that you're only getting one side of the story, which is to say Dylan Farrow's side. So the question is, did the filmmakers have an obligation to the viewer to represent more of Woody Allen's views? And what do we do with Woody's movies now? We're going to discuss that with Hadley Freeman from The Guardian and Genia Belafonte from The New York Times.
Then Time's Up has been at the forefront of calling for change at the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. Is it as simple as just adding a few Black members to the group? I'd say, of course not. And we're going to get into just what real change at the Golden Globes group might look like with the president and CEO of Time's Up, Tina Chen. But first, Sharon, let's get into some headlines.
Let's do it.
Meghan Markle and Prince Harry's bombshell interview had an unusual side effect this week. It led to Piers Morgan quitting his job. Let me explain. So Morgan's had a long, long history of making, really just vile comments about Markle, which continued in the wake of the interview. During Tuesday's episode of Good Morning Britain, Morgan's co-host Alex Beresford started to go off on Morgan and called his treatment of Markle, quote, diabolical. Morgan then, for some reason, decided to storm off the set of his own show, which I found a ridiculous proposition. And then later in the day, ITV confirmed that Morgan had indeed just decided to quit. Sharon, I think there's a lot to unpack here with Markle and Harry and Oprah and then Piers Morgan. What did you make of all of this?
I mean, I don't get what's up with Piers Morgan. Clearly, this is, you know, an instance of somebody who can dish it out and dish it out and dish it out, but he can't take it.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, that was ridiculous. First of all, his co-host, I have not paid close enough attention to Piers Morgan to know that he apparently had a drink with Meghan Markle. And I know this because this has now been on Twitter in the past couple of days, but before I had no idea. Like, he had a drink with Meghan Markle, and that night, I guess, she met Prince Harry. And after she got into that relationship, she decided to cut ties with Piers Morgan. And his co-host called him out on that, it wasn't just being insulting. It's like, you have an axe to grind with this woman who you cover. That's not cool. And we all have to sit here and listen to it. That's literally what he said, because Piers Morgan then, you know, he had gone on, he continually is insulting to Meghan Markle. And then when she gave this interview to Oprah Winfrey, and she says that she was suicidal at all of the pressure that was put on her and all the vitriol that was thrown her way by the British tabloids, Piers Morgan tweets, "Yeah, I don't believe her." So it's just like,
just terrible.
And really, it's about him. I think in general, like, the less Piers Morgan, the better. How about you?
That's a good formula. I like that math. I just will never get over the fact that he stormed off his own show. Normally, when that happens, you're a guest somewhere. The host maybe says, ask you some questions you don't like, so you leave. This was, he's the host.
No, it's like, it's kind of funny, actually, but yes.
He's the host. He's like, not on my show. And then he left. It's like, well, it's not on your show. You should be able to do something about it. It's just, you know, it brings up this whole treatment of the UK tabloids and the royals and Meghan. And then it goes back to Diana. This has been going on for just years upon years, and it'll be interesting.
This just feels
to see.
Like particularly misogynistic.
This one really stinks
of misogyny in every way. Although the British tabloids in general, but Piers is not in the British tabloids, but it's the
he
same.
He writes a column for the Daily Mail.
Oh, okay. All right, fine.
So he's
but I'm actually thinking about like those headlines and whoever writes those
headlines.
Which are devastating. And the Oprah interview surfaced just how mean they were and distorted and how loaded. In other words, like Kate, who's going to be queen, would do one thing and it would be adorable, like hold her baby bump. And Meghan Markle does, and she's doing it to be vain and get attention. It's just like, it was very, very clear that misogyny and I would say racism, or just mocking the other or rejection of the other is coming across too strongly. And really, Piers Morgan, I think he just showed his hand. He's got something up his butt about Meghan Markle. It's not a dispassionate observation of media culture when he's talking about her. It's personal. It has long felt really personal. And he just showed that it was by storming off his own show.
Yeah, I think really when you ridicule or downplay mental health in this day and age, that's when you really, you can't justify that in any way. I'm with you. I just don't understand why he has this vendetta. It seems very odd.
Also now he's been exposed. And so he's embarrassed because he had the cloak of being a columnist or being a media observer. And his colleague unmasked him saying, "You used to be friends. Now you're not." That's her choice. And she's allowed to choose.
So. Yeah, I think you said it best. The less Piers Morgan in our lives, the better.
Exactly. All right. So it has been quite a week for another new face, Alexi McCammon, who was just named editor-in-chief at Teen Vogue. Right after that announcement, more than 20 Teen Vogue staffers sent a letter to Condé Nast, which is management, to rebuke the fact of her hiring because of her, quote, past racist and homophobic tweets, close quote. McCammon apologized for tweets that she put out in 2019. And then again, she apologized to the staffers saying, quote, "There's no excuse for language like that." She had been referring to, it was anti-Asian tweets or something in school. And she issued yet another apology on Wednesday, but insisted that she intended to stay on as Teen Vogue's editor-in-chief. So it looks like she's going to stay in the gig for now. But what do you make of this, Daniel?
As a straight white male, I'm in no minority group ever, right? Like, I can't put myself in the shoes of someone that would feel like this. But if I thought my boss was making, if I were in a minority group, now this someone who's supposed to lead me is someone who thought it was okay to make these racist jokes on Twitter, I'd have a problem with that. So I don't understand.
She wasn't making
a
racist joke. I read the tweets, at least. Yeah, I haven't read all of them. She was singling out the fact that a TA or somebody she didn't like in college was Asian. But she wasn't saying, "I don't like Asians," but it was.
It was not
something that in today's culture is acceptable, and probably not even in a few years ago culture was not acceptable. It would not be acceptable. But go ahead. Continue.
Yeah, no, I think, one thing I was just going to correct you a little bit. The tweets were older than 2019, but she apologized once already in 2019 and then again.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
She's apologized a few times.
That's what I was just wondering, because I think she was in college when
these were in 2012 or 2013. She apologized, you know, 2 years ago and then again. And, you know, it is definitely tough when you get these things sort of brought back up again and again, but like, that's the consequence. I think I would have a hard time working for her if I were in a minority group like that. And so she's supposed to be the face of your publication that's supposed to represent young people and be a sort of a voice for the next generation. I don't see how she could effectively do that. I would have a hard time.
I think that it raises a larger question, which is, how do you function today? You know, when the bar is just never having said anything that might have upset someone. And personally, I think it's a good example, if I really think about it, of somebody saying, "I made a mistake. That was wrong. Let me show you how I'm going to behave in a way that is inclusive and that addresses that past mistake. And let's move forward." Personally, I think that we have to have that kind of approach or everybody's going to be off the table. I don't know that any of us is perfect none of us is perfect, that we do know, but I'm just saying that now that there are records that never go away in your Twitter feed or on Facebook, and obviously, word to the wise, watch at any age what you say on those platforms, because it will come back to haunt you. But at the same time, I think we need to find a way to say, okay, accept your apology is accepted, and we're going to hold you accountable going forward. And she did say, I'm asking you to hold me accountable. Now, it's definitely a crappy way to start a job. It's a crappy way to get introduced as an outsider to all of the staff who looks up to you as a leader, especially on something that is aimed at teenagers. So it's definitely a tough one. And Condé Nast has been struggling with this issue of cleaning house for many months now. So it's certainly not terribly auspicious, but in this sort of wave of cancel culture and outrage culture that we live in, I do think that finding a way for people to apologize and make amends and move forward is something that we need to do.
No, I absolutely agree. I believe in second chances. And to your point, I mean, not that I can be the arbiter of all things racism, you know, on the racism 1 to 10 scale, this was like a 3 or a 4. But I just think in this particular position,
I would not be in the business of rating this.
Yeah, no,
especially no right as answer. Non-Asians, I think that we
no exactly there's no right
to
answer
to the injured to say how they feel. But
exactly,
but I, in no, general, I don't think she was. Yeah.
I just think it's a tough one, and you know, I think good on her for accepting it and walking into it head forward and trying to take it on and not trying to dodge behind anything. So I do find myself rooting for her, perhaps, you know, if she can turn this into a positive thing going forward.
We shall see.
All right. Finally, this week here in Los Angeles County, the rate of COVID-19 infections has been reduced to the point where movie theaters can reopen again with a 25% capacity limit as early as next week. LA Ooh. Would join New York and San Francisco, both of which reopened the weekend of March 5th, and the news of reopening cannot come fast enough for the movie theater biz. AMC Entertainment announced this week that it lost $4.6 billion with a B in 2020. Mm-hmm. Ooh. Mm-hmm. Sharon, movie theaters are seemingly like they're going to get back on the right track again. Do you think it's going to work out, or is the movie business forever just changed by the pandemic?
The movie business has changed forever by the pandemic. I think we've established that. Listeners of the show know we've been talking about it for a full on year. We might even say for an anniversary year, because I think we launched this podcast like 2 weeks into the pandemic, seems to me. But this will be a crawl back to some form of movie business. But we've already seen that streaming services have surged to the forefront. Every studio that creates content has been leaning on its streaming service or launching its streaming service, and the movie theatrical business is just a supplement to that bet that they're making on the future. Because of course, those streaming services, with the exception of Netflix and Disney Plus, are not big enough yet to be driving the kinds of numbers that the movie business did, say for a Paramount Plus or something like that. But as a movie lover, I very much welcome it, and I hope people will go back to the movies. But again, you know, 25% capacity doesn't come close to hitting the kinds of numbers, even with full-scale releases, which I think that a lot of the studios are still holding back movies. They're going to start doling them out, and I think they're hoping that these movies that are coming now are going to start getting people back in the habit, so that when we hit the summer, they can actually see some real revenue from these releases, whatever they are coming, Black Widow or et cetera, In the Heights, which is coming, you know, the musical by Lin-Manuel Miranda coming in the summer. So it's baby steps, but AMC Theaters, I'm not looking them to see them be profitable this year, after that catastrophe of last year.
Yeah. I think it's twofold, right? You have the, am I comfortable going back into a movie theater aspect mm-hmm. of it? And mm-hmm. then you have the, you know, the game has changed. The movie will be on my streaming TV in
six weeks, 8 weeks,
much mm-hmm. shorter than it used to be. Can I wait? You know, I think you'll see, I think tentpole films will still be a thing. Like Marvel fans are not going to want to wait 2 months to watch.
Well, Daniel, will you go to the movies?
No, I don't think, I said even last year, I don't think you'll see me in a theater in 2020. In 2021.
It's sorry. 2021, yeah.
I know. I've days, months, who knows? I don't think it's worth it. Personally, I can wait. I have no problem. Mm-hmm. There's very few things where I feel like I'm drawn in. Maybe the next Fincher movie might do it for me, but that's about it. I can wait.
Well, the last Fincher movie was on Netflix, so okay.
So I'm good. Yeah. So I'm set there. Mm-hmm. We'll see. It'll be interesting. Black Widow, as you mentioned, you know, May 7th, that's going to be the big one. I think you're going to see, you know, if a theater has 10 screens, I think you might see Black Widow on 7 or 8 of them to try and get to the numbers that you can, you know, maybe open.
Well, but that was the release strategy before COVID. When Black Widow came out, they, you know, or a movie like that, they would blanket the theaters and put them in 12 out of 13 of the screens of the multiplex to satisfy demand on opening weekend. So
well, I just think with 25% capacity, you have no choice.
You have to do that anyway, but it still doesn't hit the numbers that they need to hit anyway.
Yeah. But hopefully, you know, as much as it's not for me, I still hope that the theater business is able to bounce back because it's a big part of the industry. They need it. All right. As always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow our founder and editor-in-chief, CEO, all the titles, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to talk about something she's particularly into this week, something that she was really excited about, her Wax On, and something maybe she's a little more riled up about, her Wax Off. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Daniel. So this week, my Wax On is about the Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, who's no longer a prince, right, interview. And that is hat tip to Oprah Winfrey. She really did an incredible job with this interview, which made it look as if it was just in her backyard. You know, she lives in Montecito, literally down the street from Meghan and Harry. And so it had this kind of very comfortable feel. And yet she asked all the hard questions. Now, obviously, she's had a relationship with Meghan Markle. She went to the wedding for some time. But when you put your hat on as an interviewer, you have to tread this really, especially a celebrity interview, especially somebody who has been hiding from the media and felt very much under attack by the media. It's a very specific line you have to walk between making that person feel safe enough to share something authentic and real and getting to the heart of the questions that your viewers want to see. She did a really fantastic job, I think, across the board. She just got great reviews and great feedback. But that was, I think this interview will go down in the history of this period of time in the same way that the Princess Diana interview went down in history as a definitive piece of cultural history. Was it 1995, I think, that interview happened? So really hats off and kudos to Oprah. She is not royal, but she is a queen of the interview. That's my wax on. My wax off also relates to that interview, which is many of us, and I among them, was very shocked to hear about the level of racism that apparently is part of the workaday conversation inside Buckingham Palace. Meghan Markle and Harry backed her up, said that there was a discussion about what color of the skin of their new baby, who is Archie, would be, and that a member of the royal family brought up that discussion to Harry. She said it wasn't Queen Elizabeth and it wasn't Prince Philip. And since then, Prince William, Harry's brother, has said that there's no racism in our family. I think it would be a lot to expect that there would be no racism in a family that is the very definition of privilege, and that is the very definition of living in a bubble outside of the experiences and the challenges that regular people face in their country and in the Commonwealth across the world. But the idea that that would be even spoken, an idea like that, is so repugnant. I thought Oprah's reaction, which was just what a different face when she said it, was priceless. And I think that was how a lot of us felt. and they need to answer for it, and they can't just deflect and say that wasn't us. And I think the only way forward, this is justifiably a major crisis for the royal family, is to address it and own it like everyone else in the world who has their reckoning with race. It sounds like the royal family has to have their own reckoning with race. Daniel, how about you?
Yeah, I'm going to wax on for Tammy Duckworth. Sometimes I believe brevity is the soul of wit. And she responded to Tucker Carlson making cracks about women in the military by tweeting, "Fuck Tucker Carlson." While he was practicing his two-step, America's female warriors were hunting down Al-Qaeda and proving the strength of America's women. Happy belated International Women's Day to everyone but Tucker, who even I can dance better than. I thought it was a brilliant tweet from Tammy.
Great.
Just who obviously is a decorated soldier. I believe she won a Purple Heart. Yep. Senator from Illinois. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. You know, sometimes I think sometimes people go, a member of the Senate shouldn't be using language like that. No. He deserves it. Of all people who deserve an F-bomb, Tucker Carlson. So my hat's off to Tammy Duckworth this week, and my hat's off to everything Tucker Carlson has pretty much ever done. All right, that'll do it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, we're going to dig deep into the documentary series Alan V. Farrow, and then we'll be joined by Time's Up CEO Tina Chen. Stay tuned.
Alan V. Farrow is the HBO documentary series that tells the story of the bitter breakup of Woody Allen and Mia Farrow, his affair with her adopted daughter, Suni Previn, and the allegation of child molestation made against him by their daughter, Dylan. The series doesn't really unearth anything new aside from showing the video of 7-year-old Dylan recounting the alleged abuse, though what was said in the video has been widely reported for years. The series is pretty clear on which side of Alan V. Farrow it's actually on. But did the directors Amy Ziering and Kirby Dick owe it to the viewer to try and tell the other side? And if you find yourself siding with Dylan Farrow, how should you approach Woody Allen movies going forward? Here to help us discuss this are the Guardians, Hadley Freeman and Genia Belafonte from the New York Times. Welcome.
Hi.
So there's so much to talk about with this series, and yet a big part of me wants to never have anything to, like, not spend another word of my life talking about Alan V. Farrow when so much other abuse has been exposed and this has been picked over. This is now the third time I would say it's going through forensic proctology analysis. So thankfully, Hadley, you're here to remind us that this is not all brand new. And you wrote a really good piece, I thought, in The Guardian about what the documentary series doesn't ask, and asks the very valid question to my mind as to why it doesn't ask those questions. So can you recount for us here a little bit about what bothered you about what was not in the series?
Well, that's very kind of you to say that about the piece, Sharon, and thank you so much for having me on today. The series is kind of extraordinary in that it's this major four-part, 4-hour-plus series, and yet it only puts forward one side of the case. I know the director said they asked to interview Woody Allen, and he said no, but they don't have anyone who represented his side. They don't even have anyone representing his side in it. There is no mention of the many people who testified in his defense, who spoke out in his defense during the time. People like Monica Thompson, who was the family nanny, who said that she'd been forced to say by Mia Farrow that all the terrible things that Farrow accused Allen of doing, and actually Woody Allen was a great dad and none of these things were true. There's nothing from the family's therapist, about the family's therapist, Dr. Nancy Schultz, Dr. Susan Coates, both of whom spoke out very much against the idea that Woody Allen had molested Dylan. And there are other allegations that they put forward in the documentary that are just sort of put forward with no argument. And actually Woody Allen and his people have denied them very firmly over the years. The most prominent one is that Woody Allen was in therapy for inappropriate feelings towards Dylan. Now, Woody Allen has denied that very firmly on the record many times since, and people may not believe his denial, but you would think that that denial would be included in the show. The whole theory about him having inappropriate feelings towards Dylan comes comes from a testimony from Dr. Coates, in which she said that Alan's relationship with Dylan was inappropriately intense, but not sexual. And what she meant by that, as she elaborated in her notes, was that it excluded the other children. He was only interested really in Dylan. He wasn't interested in Mia Farrow's children with Andre Previn. None of that's included. You just get the impression that Woody Allen had these intensely sexual feelings for his adopted child. And so it's like hearing just the first half of a case. You're just hearing the prosecution and there is nothing for the defense.
Mm-hmm. And which is a bit surprising because Amy and Kirby, who we've interviewed many times, I admire their body of work enormously. And in fact, we invited them on the podcast. They were booked to come on this week and then had a scheduling issue. It surprises me a bit. Jeannie, let me just ask you, you wrote a very compelling essay this weekend in the New York Times, or last weekend, I should say, talking about your own feelings toward Manhattan. I take from that, there's a lot to talk about that and we'll get to that. But first, let me just say, it seems that you come to this from the perspective that you do believe Dylan Farrow and that this series, or perhaps the, just preponderance of what's come out to this point about Woody Allen has left you feeling like you just can't, you have to reject him essentially as a valid person to weigh in on our culture in some way.
I don't have that degree of certainty about so much of this stuff that we're going through right now.
Yeah.
It's so hard, and I've certainly gone back and forth and back and forth. What I wanted to explore in the piece specifically, apart from whether he is guilty of abusing Dylan or not, what one thing that really struck me in the documentary is that the seduction of Sun Yi is in itself just very disturbing. And in that moment in the documentary where they feature the audio clip from his book where he says, you know, and I made a move on her in the screening room, it's just, it's so tone deaf. It sounds as though, you know, he's courting Diane Sawyer or something, not, the teenager or the very, very, you know, young daughter of his girlfriend. So I was very drawn into that. I agree there's lots of glaring holes, you know, in the documentary and questions that you want answered that they don't really address. But for me, it was personal because Manhattan, Woody Allen, but specifically Manhattan, was an absolutely transformative experience in my life. And it really gave me, you know, a vision of how I wanted to live. An intellectual New York life with fun, but, you know, and as somebody, a friend of mine said, well, you know, well, he did something because you achieved, you know, you are doing
it. I was about to say, you did that, yeah.
But, you know, I could not believe watching it again that no one in my life, no one in the life of my friends who are, you know, also very fascinated with me, ever really noticed that this was a movie, you know, a romantic comedy. It is a romantic comedy, and probably, you know, one of the best, quote unquote, best in terms of its writing and cinematography ever made. And it's about a 42-year-old man and a 17-year-old girl. And there was, and so I was really interested in the question of the culture and specifically the parenting culture of the 1970s that made this a non-event, you know, a complete, it was a non-issue. Nobody really at the time was exploring why this was okay. And many parents, you know, were totally blind to the kind of things they were doing, blind to the fact that their own daughters might be dating older men, blind to what they were doing after school or drinking or whatever, you know. And of course, you know, I've come to this now as a parent for this. I should say, first time I've watched it as a parent. And so I'm doing a lot of revisionist history of my own life and the culture of parenting then and family life then. But there was so much absenteeism, I think, because, you know, your kids in the 70s were raised by people who were a little bit too old to have for the sexual revolution, right? They weren't 18 in 1968, and they felt like they missed out, and there was this huge rate of divorce, and people were going out and having their own good times, and you know, the kids really weren't all right.
Well, okay. I want to pass it to Daniel, but I do want to say, so Jeannie and I both went to Barnard, which is a women's college, at around that time, right? Like in the years after Manhattan came out, I met a ton of women at Barnard at when I was 18 who had done that, who had snuck out of the house from their house in Long Island, were singing in jazz clubs in the city. And by the way, they're super self-possessed young women who went at that time, who then went on to become, in some one case I'm thinking, an investment banker. She's married, she has four kids. It's like, so I just want to be careful that we're not, you know, helicopter parenting and backwards, you know.
Right.
Women who are ready to take their own, possess their own agency at age 18, 17, 18, you're right, that's right there in the, on the cusp of the danger zone. But I do think that there's a big difference when you see that when you're that age and wide-eyed. And of course, I saw it coming from a very cloistered environment in Cleveland, Ohio, where there was, my parents knew everything that I did. And so therefore going to college was the moment when you could step into all the stuff that you dreamed about in the city of New York. So, and then looking at it as a parent, which of course we do today. Anyway, Daniel, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, I'd never really followed this case super closely. I was, I think like 15 or 16 when the, in 92, 93. And what struck me watching this documentary is that this story has not changed ever since. There's not been one new thing over the years,
right.
But in when Dylan wrote her first essay in 2014, not a lot happened to Woody. And then in 2018, she brought it back up again. And then finally, it sort of caught up with him. Why do you think it took so long for any cultural consequences, I guess, to really come to him?
Yeah. Or is it appropriate that cultural consequences?
Yeah.
I think it's both. But anyway.
No, yeah. I agree.
Hadley.
I think the question of if it's appropriate is really important here, because the reason that these charges or these allegations have had so much power now is that we've had this revisionist history that you mentioned, Sharon, and you mentioned too, Ginia, that we've realized that so many women have been ignored over the years, that sexual assault and sexual abuse has been downplayed over the years. And this case has been swept up into that. But the fact of this case is that actually these allegations were looked into very seriously at the time. They were investigated by the New Haven Yale Sexual Abuse Clinic. They were investigated by the New York State Clinic. That, you know, they have been really investigated. And I know that the documentary casts doubts on those investigations, but a lot of other people do not cast doubts on them. And the documentary really only interviews half of them. And I've interviewed people in confidence connected to both of those investigations, and they stand by them very firmly. And Dylan's story has been heard many times over the years. As you say, Sharon, she wrote her editorial in 2014. She's been interviewed on CBS. Her and her brother Ronan have spoken out. This is not one of those cases where she hasn't been listened to, where we haven't heard the Farrow side of the story. You know, the documentary makes great play about how powerful Woody Allen is, that he had all these publicists around him. He had this legal team around him. Well, the Farrows had their people around them too. And we see some of them in the documentary. You know, we see Maureen Orth, who's a very powerful writer at Vanity Fair, and she's been writing articles from the Farrows' point of view since 1992 and been very instrumental in shaping public opinion about them. And you mentioned Dylan's piece, Sharon. Well, she wrote that piece in Nick Kristof's blog spot in the New York Times. So, you know, they themselves have had journalists helping them put their case out. So this is not a case that, like you say, that has had any new information. It's also not a case that was ignored at the time. It was investigated very, very seriously. Why has it come back now? Well, there's a whole new generation of kids and of people who weren't around at the time who don't remember how seriously this case was investigated. Also, there has been, as you say, a cultural change, the Me Too movement in 2018, people wanting to listen to these women, and also a realization of how many powerful men out there have exploited women and exploited their position. And we've seen, you know, Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein, Larry Nassar, the U.S. gymnastics guy, and lots of other people, R. Kelly, Michael Jackson, lots of people over the years. Now, in all of those cases, there are multiple allegations going back many decades, multiple incidents, patterns of behavior, and in many of those cases, charges and often convictions. Woody Allen's case doesn't fit that pattern. We're talking about one allegation, one incident. And I know that the documentary, and in, for the media and the public too, they sort of package the Sun Yi relationship up with the Dylan allegation. I would very strongly say those are different. We all may be grossed out by the idea that he made a move on his girlfriend's adopted daughter. She was a grown-up at the time. The documentary says she was 18. Sunny has said she's 21. You know, there's been this big movement of believe women. Like, that's what we're told now post Me Too. Well, we could also believe Sunny, who has spoken out a lot about the nature of their relationship. You know, we can listen to lots of women. We can listen to Dylan and we can listen to Sunny as well. The Alan case, this is, you know, it's not like I'm out here trying to, you know, argue Alan's innocence. I don't know any better than anyone else here what happened that day in 1992. Right. What I'm saying is that Woody Allen's case is extremely different from Harvey Weinstein and Jeffrey Epstein and other people who various people like Maureen Dowd now list him with when they write him about him. And to be honest, that is just lazy thinking.
I mean, I think that's you make a very powerful case. For many years, you know, one of the points that you made in your piece, Hadley, that I thought was really striking was the fact that this is now being laid out as the story for a new generation of young people who didn't spend the time that you spent looking at it over the past 20 years and didn't have the benefit of just coming to your own conclusions. My own conclusions about it, having looked at it a couple of times over the years, we do a tremendous amount of reporting. I personally have, the RAP does, about the Me Too movement, was I could never come to a clear conclusion about what it was. It isn't that I don't want to believe Dylan Farrow. Of course we want to believe Dylan Farrow. It's not that there is not an enormous ick factor around Woody Allen, but that doesn't, it was certainly confirmed for me when he left Mia Farrow for Suni Previn, which is just gross. I'm sorry. However, exactly, like, yes, she was not his stepdaughter, not his daughter. It's just, ew, go, if you're really going to leave your partner, go fish in other waters. But it's also evident just from looking at his body of work as a female from the early on, it's like, okay, the guy's got a thing for nerdy men winning over nubile women inappropriate to their age. But if we're going to judge people on that, like, Hollywood is full of couples like that. I once embarrassed myself badly. I sat at a Hollywood dinner next to a very prominent director who was there with his wife. And I said something about his daughter. And he, because she was like 40 years younger than him. He's a well-known director. If I named him, you all would know who he was. And I was like, whoops, I wasn't clued in when I sat down at this dinner. I just made a really stupid assumption. And he took it really badly and he got up and left the table.
Yes, but also,
like, this is totally normal. What's the matter with you? So she's 40 years younger than me. We're in love. So what am I, you know?
But younger women are different from little girls. You know, I've always been grossed out by Manhattan. You know, I never could understand how this was this big successful movie. It's such a weird idea, this older man dating a girl who needs to do her homework, as he says in the film. But whether she's 21, 18, whatever, that is extremely different from 7. And I think it's incredibly infantilizing, to be honest, to talk about, oh, well, Woody Allen makes these movies with, you know, these younger women, 21-year-olds, 22-year-olds, you know, being these, you know, the romance, you know, they're the romantic leads. That's a 22-year-old woman is not a 7-year-old little girl. Like, can we just establish that?
Well, exactly. But it all seems, well, that was the thing I wanted to ask Genia, which is, do you think that you would be having this re-examination of Manhattan if Dylan Farrow didn't exist, was not in the picture, and that allegation was not there?
Sure. I mean, I think I would have, you know, it's certainly something since Me Too, I have been meaning to revisit, you know, and I got very sucked into the documentary, and a few friends had rewatched it, and that's what made me do it. But I certainly started, you know, I almost didn't want to revisit it right at Me Too because it was so important. I wanted to still love it, and I don't anymore because and it's not even really just the gross factor of the relationship. It's the utter moral hypocrisy that, you know, as a young person, you don't necessarily, you're not intuitive enough to understand. But there's a, you know, the absolute crucial scene in the movie is when he is in the classroom with Yale in front of the skeleton, and Yale is going to leave his wife to go to the Diane Keaton character, and he does this moralizing speech, you know, about the, you know, about how, you know, Emily's a wonderful person and fidelity is horrible. So he gives himself the moral authority in a movie where he does whatever he wants, when he wants, when he only goes back to the Mariel Hemingway, sweet, devoted 17-year-old because he's been dumped by somebody else. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I wasn't, you know, it's that I, you know, I'm angry at myself. I fell for that utter bullshit hypocrisy. And, you know, I got a really interesting letter. One thing that, you know, in the movie, as a young person later on, you see Bella Abzug, there's a scene set for at an ERA fundraiser at MoMA, and you think, well, okay, the feminists, you know, what could be bad if Bella Abzug's in it? Well, when my column came out, I got a letter from her press secretary in 1979.
Wow. Who said
that she did not, famously, Woody Allen, you know, I have lots of actor friends who've auditioned for him, and you never, if you have a small role, you are not told what the story is. That's just, you know, he's done that for decades. Bella did not know what the movie was about. He was apparently, you know, she knew it was a love letter to New York. It's 1978 in New York City. The city is going to shit, right? People are moving out. Of course, if you're a politician, you're going to want to be in a movie that's a love letter to New York. And when it came out, she was utterly horrified.
But she didn't say anything.
She didn't. I don't know that she spoke out. She might have. I don't know. But, you know, she certainly was.
I mean, Manhattan was covered in glory. So, you know.
Yeah.
I think these are really touchy questions when you're talking about the artistic vision of a director. I mean, I could talk about endlessly, because mainly what we do is cover entertainment at The Wrap, about movies that I found morally repugnant that everybody was just like, oh, okay. There's one that had one in particular. I could never watch another one of his movies. It has nothing to do with sex. It was all about it's kind of an orgy of violence and evisceration and celebration and heightening it in such a way as to make it like beautiful, but horrible at the same time. The guy's gotten work after this one film, but I was supposed to write about, like, I absolutely couldn't there, but that's really an exception. In the main, it's not our job to judge the morality of what artists produce, is it?
Well, I think we're doing that.
You can deal with that. I mean, I used to think about Picasso all the time, who like dumped one woman after another and was like horrible to the women in his life. Does that mean we shouldn't look at his paintings? I'm sorry, Hadley, you were going to say something.
I think that question is been so played over and played over and played over,
right,
to a point of triteness. I mean, for me, the Woody Allen, you know, particularly Manhattan, but the oeuvre in general is you don't need to do that. Separate it from, you know, it's making some kind of moral argument that it doesn't live up to. Who cares? You don't even need to separate the art from the person. You can separate the art from the homage. Is it deserving of all this? It isn't. It just isn't.
In and of itself.
He has no standing as a moral arbiter, and we allowed him to have it, you know, and as an arbiter for a way to live a life in New York, an arbiter for a certain kind of urbanity. Does he deserve it? No, I don't think he does. Yes, he's a very, you know, he's just an intelligent person, but the more you read about him, and I went back and read all the coverage from 1979, huge profiles, and the lack of self-awareness. You know, he doesn't even realize how one sentence discredits the next, because the person who's been in psychoanalysis all this time, you know, actually seems to have very little psychological acuity, it seems to me. You know, I don't know him, I cannot say,
but
the presentation feels like a shell game in a bit.
Sorry. So now it sounds like you're arguing that the work and his oeuvre that posits itself as a moral arbiter, all of that is out of bounds for you.
Yeah. I still laughed my head off when Diane Keaton said, you know, Gustav Mahler, we have the Academy of the Overrated, right? That's still funny, but it was not received for one second just as a romantic comedy. This is, we're not talking about 2 weeks' notice, you know, we're talking about a movie that really gave Woody Allen a standing that he didn't have. It was supposed to be serious. It was supposed to give him this moral authority. And so that's where I have the conflict. It's not about what he did in his personal life. It's really, for me, it's looking at the movie, what it's trying to say, and what it does say.
So, right. So if he had stayed with Mia Farrow all of this time, today, from where you sit, you'd still feel the same way.
I would. Absolutely.
That's interesting.
I don't think
Woody, I think, is just, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't know if Woody Allen ever set out to be a moral arbiter. I think that is a mantle perhaps others put on him.
Read the 1979 profile in the New York Times Magazine and tell me if you feel the same way.
No, I'm not arguing his morality, but you know, he, in his movies, he certainly presents a way of life that did become aspirational. You know, I grew up in New York in the 80s, and I remember, you know, seeing the influence of things like Hannah and Her Sisters and stuff. You know, this was a world that people wanted to buy into, this Upper East Side life, intelligentsia, all the things that Genia said. But I don't think that, I mean, he wasn't a politician. It's not like he was saying, be me. He was making art as he wanted the world for him to be. I don't think that you know, his movies are full of incredibly morally flawed persons. He presents himself as deeply flawed, you know, hypochondriac, always in therapy.
But those aren't character questions. Those are personality traits, two absolutely different issues.
For sure. But I don't think he wanted to be, you know, he wasn't setting himself out as the king of morality. I think that's something that we as New Yorkers, like I'm a Jewish New Yorker, like he very much was, you know, Mr. New York to me for a long time. I think that's something we all put on him, which is a slightly different issue.
No, he was extremely, again, go read, you know, read the things he said in the 70s. He was extremely judgmental of lots of aspects of the culture in which he did participate. Mm-hmm. The morally dubious aspects of the culture in which he did participate, he had no problem with. So, right. You know, that's both as an artist and as, you know, as a human being. So,
Then the question is, so where do we end up? Because part of this for me is like when I go back and I review and I say Dylan Farrow has had her say, what does Dylan Farrow want at this point? Because legally this is no longer a question. She, as Hadley pointed out, or as we've discussed, she had her say in the New York Times. Can't get a bigger platform than that. She had her say on CBS, and now she's had her say for 4 hours on HBO, in which she has said the same thing. I don't know if it feels to me that she's achieved in the past 2 years what she wants, which is that nobody will work with Woody Allen anymore, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in that CBS interview, she says, yes, of course I want to destroy him. Why shouldn't I? I'm angry. So I don't know if there's anything more to be achieved here and what and if the series is in fact leaving us with an imbalanced view. I don't know if it's a net plus. I don't know. Hadley, what do you think?
I think that's a really good question of what the Farrow family wants at this point. I think they want everyone to believe their side of the story, and I understand that, and I have enormous empathy for the pain they've been through. But we can't go around just, you know, assuming people that they've committed terrible crimes without it going through the courts. That is not respecting of due process. You know, like I say, he was investigated twice. He wasn't even charged. You know, the goal of the Me Too process and the goal of a just society should be that all women are listened to, that anyone who says that they've been a victim of crime should be listened to. That doesn't necessarily mean that they need to be believed and that the person who they say committed these crimes should be drummed out of society. To all intents and purposes, Woody Allen has kind of been evicted from the society that he used to belong to. Yes. You know, he tried to donate money to Hillary Clinton's campaign and she returned it. You know, actors don't work with him. His movies aren't released so much in the US anymore. You know, Ronan Farrow successfully lobbied for the publisher to drop his memoir, something that is interestingly not mentioned in the documentary because that would show how successful the Farrows have been. The documentary posits the idea that the Farrows are still being ignored, that Woody Allen is still this almighty, you know, patriarchal figure who's causing all this terror. Well, in fact, the Farrows have achieved what they wanted. So I think it's now up to people. I would hope that people would watch that documentary, be able to see how one-sided it is, and look to the other side, because that is how a democratic society works. Both sides are heard, and they should be heard.
Yeah, I know. For me, this definitely gave me a lot to think about, and you guys as well gave me even more to think about. Genia, finish up.
Sorry, I was just going to say one thing. There was an article recently in the New York Times about the documentary. And, you know, it did acknowledge that the documentary is very one-sided and said, well, maybe that's how things have to be with allegations of sex abuse. That is not how things have to be with allegations of sex abuse. Even in the worst crimes, both sides should be heard. That is how Western democracy works. And I understand and admire this impulse to right the wrongs of the past. But not all cases are the same. Each case has to be looked on its individual merit. And in all cases, both sides need to be heard.
I mean, I think that Woody's, as we've read, you know, they were asked, Woody and Sunyi were asked to be in the documentary. They said no. They have clips from the 60 Minutes interview in 1992, where he is very ardently defending himself. I mean, again, because this case has been litigated publicly for 30 years, there's plenty of information on both sides, you know, out there, and people are free certainly to, you know, click on a hyperlink and find out more. I mean, all documentaries have a point of view, and the filmmakers clearly believe that Dylan is telling the truth, and that perhaps what he does deserve, you know, some further degree of cancellation. I don't know.
I actually have to disagree there, Jeannie. My daughter, who's in her 20s, watched it avidly, and then I sent her Hadley's piece, and she said she was completely confused. I don't think that people watch a documentary and presume that it has a point of view and therefore is not presenting certain information that might detract from its thesis. I mean, I think I'm, of course, documentarians have a point of view, but they have to be honest brokers. And generally, Amy Ziering and Kirby Dick absolutely are honest brokers. So, you know, when we have the opportunity, we will ask them about.
I'd love to hear, you know, I mean, there's certain questions about, you know, the Yale New Haven study, for example.
Right.
Well, if it in fact was doctored, which I'm willing to believe, why is John Leventhal not been, why is he still Yale 30 years later? I mean, there are questions like that, very specific questions.
Sure. Why were the notes destroyed? You know?
Yeah. Well, notes are always, I mean, any lawyer will tell you notes are never destroyed. I mean, right. It's crazy to destroy the note. So, right. I wish they had addressed that. So you're not left with these gnawing questions, you know.
Why does Moses Farrow so ardently, you know?
I was going to say, I felt like Moses, you know, we're, the documentary tells us to listen to Dylan and then not listen to Moses, and I'm not sure why it makes such a black and white decision that one is right and one is wrong.
Or not his stuff is Sunyi either. I mean, both Sunyi and Moses have said that they were abused. You know, we're supposed to listen to victims of abuse, and yet at the same time, we're not supposed to listen to them. I mean, that is ridiculous. And, you know, yes, they do reference Woody Allen's, you know, 1992 60 Minutes interview, but they left out a lot of the key things that he said in it, such as that he says in it that Mia Farrow called him up after the affair with Sunyi was discovered and said, "You took away my daughter, I'm going to take away yours." Now, whether you believe that or not, that's not the issue. That should be asked. I mean, that is on the record. You know, there were lots of various incriminating things, potentially incriminating things against Farrow that are left out of the documentary. And I'm not saying they're true. Like I say, I have no idea, but it's hard to take a documentary seriously when it is so determinedly presenting just one side. Mm.
Okay, guys, I think that's fascinating. And I think this whole conversation about how do we how do we treat cases in which the law has already weighed in, and yet the debate goes on in the public sphere, and then that, and when that debate, you know, it gravitates around one of an important creator in our society, how do we then treat and approach their work? This is not an easy question. I welcome further discussion about it because I certainly haven't come to any firm conclusions. And I think we have to keep an open mind about the discussion, really. So thank you, Hadley. Thank you, Jeannie, for making us more thoughtful.
Bye.
And yes, thank you for joining us.
Possibly confused.
Bye-bye.
The Hollywood Foreign Press Association has faced calls for serious reform in the wake of an LA Times expose that revealed that the organization does not have a single Black member. Among those leading the charge is the activist group Time's Up, which this week demanded that every member of the HFPA resign, yes, that's right, and reapply for membership, and that the board be completely replaced. Here to discuss this is the president and chief executive officer of Time's Up, Tina Chen. Welcome, Tina.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
So I want to just quickly add that we did reach out to the HFPA and ask them if they wanted to have somebody here for this discussion. They referred us to their previous statements on the issue and said, quote, "We know we have a lot to do and we are committed to listening, learning, and putting in the work." So that's what they have to say. So Tina, let me just start with a basic question, which is why did you even take this on? Time's Up is nominally an organization that we know of as interested in listening to women, hearing women out, and addressing the issue of sexual harassment, abuse, and assault, and other issues related to women. So why this issue?
Well, you're right. You know, Time's Up was born out of the moment of the reporting on the Harvey Weinstein allegations in 2017. And that sort of ripping the cover off the secret that was how pervasive sexual harassment is, and not just in the entertainment industry, but across the country in all industries. And but fueled by women of Hollywood, honestly, coming together in that moment and reaching out across industries to address sexual harassment. But we also know, you know, sexual harassment persists when you've got power structures that don't include women, don't include people of color, don't include LGBTQIA or disabled folks, you know, that's what creates a toxic culture, whether it's inside a company or inside our broader culture, that doesn't value women and their contributions, doesn't value the contributions of Black people, Latinos, African-American, you know, Asians, you know, does right. not really be fully inclusive. And so our broader mission is to create safe, fair, and dignified work for everyone. And one of the ways you have to do that is to go at power brokers, go at the gatekeepers. And, you know, we were famously launched on the Golden Globes red carpet 3 years
That's
ago,
right.
you know,
That's right.
the Black Pins, that was the first announcement yeah. that said, here's Time's Up and our first initiative, the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. Well, you know, then we've been around before, because then the next year, last year it was, what about women directors, right? And what happened in that very show that we launched Time's Up on, you know, all of a sudden they had ignored women directors, as they've been ignoring them, as you know, Sharon, for decades. Mm-hmm. But, you know, mm-hmm. it came up in a moment where, you know, we don't want to take anything away from the nominees who are, you know, colleagues and their moment of celebration. So we didn't boycott. We didn't quite do anything last year. And then it happened again this year. And with the LA Times article, with that finding of no Black member, not only just right now, but for the last two decades, they have not had a Black member. Mm-hmm. In a year when we've had the national reckoning on racial justice that this country has seen, I think we all looked at each other and said, how could we not say something? Like, we've really felt obligated to call this out in this moment. And not just, here's the thing, that one fact is really just, as with so many things, the tip of the iceberg of so many other things that are wrong, that have been, as you know, Cher, wrong for a long time with the HFPA, not just the exclusion of diverse artists and therefore the impact on their careers and their long-standing livelihoods, you know, whether you get an entry in a golden ticket into the Oscars or not can affect your career for a long time, but also the kinds of abuses and the ethical abuses and even the actual sexual harassment that occurs at HFPA events. So that's why it felt important.
Sexual harassment that occurs at HFPA
events. Well, you know, you've probably seen it, you know, Brandon Fraser, you know, reported on being grabbed at an HFPA.
Oh, I wrote that story.
Right.
Pretty much any one of these. I'll probably say I wrote that story. Yes.
Yes.
Brandon Fraser being, yes, having his ass grabbed by Phil Burke, who I then get, he then trashed me in his book. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not sure I would endorse the fact that the HFPA is known for sexual harassment. That was one incident and extremely embarrassing. It is known for extremely embarrassing behavior. But anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Continue. No, well, but here's the thing. It is, you know, you normally wouldn't care, right? You know, this is kind of a private club, right? It looks like, you know, when you look at it's 87 folks, they've got very narrow membership criteria. They don't even admit people who meet the membership criteria, right? They make their
That's
own
right.
decisions about who to let into the club. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, who you want to let into your private club doesn't really matter, except when you're given a platform like the Golden Globes that mm-hmm. is viewed as the gateway, right, to the Oscars, that makes or breaks careers if you can get that nomination. And therefore they have this outsized effect on, you know, who gets recognized, who is valued, And when you exclude Black artists from that, when you exclude women directors from that, you know, you are really having a broader impact on our culture. And that all from the fact that they're not representative.
We should point out they didn't exclude, they did exclude some Black directed projects this year, but they did include many others. I am not here to defend the HFPA or the Golden Globes, but I just want to make sure that we're factual. In fact, there were a number of African-American winners at the Golden Globes this year. So, and this diversity, some kind, not a lot in the HFPA. I was looking back through the things, the many, many, many stories I've written about the HFPA over the years, which have mainly been about corruption, because it's, of course, anytime you have a club, it is highly corruptible. And the HFPA makes, it's this very bizarre, anomalous situation where they make millions of dollars off the NBC telecast, and yet the members themselves are often freelance writers who don't have very much money, and so they are often mocked for or talked about sort of in a derisive way for taking food off of the banquet table at events that are put on for them. And in 2013, we point, I had a story about a Black journalist who was rejected, her application was rejected, and pointed out at that time that there were no Black members back in 2013. But again, I think that you know, timing is important, and the Black Lives Matter movement and the Time's Up and Me Too movements have made these things unacceptable. We should also point out that one of the very disturbing things that the LA Times story revealed was this sort of self-dealing, members paying themselves to serve on committees and watch movies, which is kind of ridiculous. So, but I want to ask you, Tina, the recommendations that Time's Up made are kind of stunning in their audacity, because calling on every single member to resign is as bold as it can get, resign and reapply. You've called on them to increase their membership by like
threefold,
3.5-fold, mm-hmm. Yeah, to 300. I would have gone for 500 myself, but 300 is better than 87. You've called on them to move the date of the telecast. What are the chances of it actually happening?
You know, well, I don't know. And Sharon, you probably know the industry even better than I do on what the chances are, but we felt it was time for bold moves, right? If any time, you know, there was, these are long reported, as you know, problems that have existed with that change. And in this year where we have, everybody's got to step up and address these issues of racism and sexism in our culture. Mm-hmm. And if not now, when, right? So we decided we would put out a bold agenda and a roadmap for this, and see what they can do. You know,
are they working with you? Are you talking? You also called on the board to resign. You basically called on everybody to resign. So,
well, everyone to resign, but to work on new criteria, right? So that you would have real journalists there. You would have, you know, diversity criteria in there to have, you know, we called upon, because we know it's a year of transition, to have an outside independent expert, you know, assist in that process until they get new leadership. Mm-hmm. Because since, as you've been reporting on this for many years, they haven't addressed those issues. They sort of have a demonstrated inability to address them. They've already shown that the existing leadership has not taken this seriously in the past. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we're saying you need fresh leadership in here to restore both credibility to the organization and then credibility to the decision-making they're making, right?
Well, one of the things we reported exclusively this week was that people inside the organization, this came out right before your statement came out, people inside the organization are calling for the board to resign and for a new administration to be installed. And they are looking for fresh leadership. I mean, there is this sort of merry-go-round of leadership that is well known, that they just, you know, shift jobs in different you know, sort of boards, and they scratch, and there's a lot of back scratching, as would happen in any organization where there's a lot of perks to be had and, you know, just sort of privilege. But, you know, again, I point out that, you know, it is a nonprofit. It needs to live up to the regulations and the laws that govern nonprofits. And I think that it's, I have often said it's problematic because this outsized weight is placed upon the shoulders of this organization, which is the weight of all of the marketing needs of the television and film community. And NBC has a dog in the hunt, and Dick Clark Productions has a dog in the hunt, and anybody who wants an Oscar or a Golden Globe has a dog in the hunt, which has created this complicity for so many years. I don't really even know how they'd go about it, although they have announced that they are going to do some of the things that you were asking for, even on their own, hire a law firm, hire an outside, I don't know if it's an investigator or an auditor of some kind. Do you think this can be done in a year?
Well, I do, because look, you know, I chair the Grammy task force, right, on diversity and inclusion for the Grammys. That we did take a year, right, to have to study it. Came out with a report with 18 recommendations. You know, they've implemented 17 of the 18 now.
That's good.
But yeah, but that's, you know, there's thousands of members of the Grammys, right? This is 87 members. So, well, you know, my point is here is the upside to the fact that they're so small right now is it's not having to change an organization has tens of thousands of members and creators, you know, in the process. You know, this is 87 members. You know, that's, the Grammy board is half the size of that membership, right? You know, so, you know, you
exactly know, right.
It's a manageable number of members and structures that you can address and you can actually change if you're serious about making a fundamental change. But here's what is hard. I mean, I recognize that there are folks who are used to a way of doing business and a way of life that they, you know, the HFPA is a part of. And that is going to be hard. And
yeah, you called for like ending the press conferences. That's what they use to write their stories. You know, when you see all those photos of movie stars with every single solitary member of the HFPA, I mean, that used to be the reason for that used to be to prove to your home paper in Hungary that you actually interviewed Tom Cruise and you didn't just make it up. But it became this sort of weird ritual where there's all there's the obligatory photo. So, I mean, I think the corruption question is very deep. You mentioned that you worked with the organization behind the Grammys. Do you have any sense whether Time's Up will be invited to work with the HFPA or perhaps with NBC on this?
You know, I don't know. We have addressed our, you know, list of recommendations to, you know, Comcast, NBC Universal, Dick Clark, and the HFPA. We're certainly willing to meet with them. I've had some communications with the HFPA, but we have not had a meeting. And, you know, we've told them that we're open to sitting down. But we decided we would be clear and we want to be transparent. Transparency is important here too. So that the industry knows and can see what's going on. And we, you know, wanted to put the recommendations out there. And here's the other reason, Sharon, we did it right now because the Golden Globes just finished. So it's a question, why would you do it now? We want to do it now because we don't want to get put in the position as we've been in the last couple of years of waiting till the nominations come out. People are unhappy about what's happened, and yet you have nominees that you care a lot about too, that you don't want to. We ought to be able to see now whether they're serious about change in time for everyone to decide, are you going to participate in the Golden Globes for 2022 or not? I mean, that's what we're pushing.
Do you think that could happen, that people may opt out?
Well, I don't know. I can't speak for, and I think.
Would you call for that if you don't see the kinds of reforms? I mean, you're asking for, it's a very big ask. You're asking everybody to resign, the board to go bye-bye, give up press conferences, move the date. Those are very, very big asks. And I would be hard pressed to believe that they're going to do that, even if they do try to reform. So if they don't meet your bar, what will you do?
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, look, Sharon, I'm a big believer in take things one step at a time, you know, and give people a chance to now we have set a bar out there. Let's see whether they meet that or how close they can come. But let's wait and see what happens. But, you know, these are all things that if you have a will to change, are possible to do with an 87 member organization.
Yeah, I agree. The will has never been there. Before we let you go, I do want to ask you, since you were kind enough to come on our podcast today, Time's Up has been dealing with its own issue internally. I've read, or we actually report on the fact that a large number of the healthcare division of Time's Up resigned in protest over how Time's Up has dealt with an accusation of sexual harassment, I believe, of somebody related to an executive in the healthcare portion of Time's Up. What is going on there, and how are you dealing with that?
So specifically what you're referring to, there is a lawsuit that was just filed, I guess a few weeks ago by an unnamed plaintiff. She has kept her name just by her initials in Oregon against Oregon Health Systems University, which is the Oregon State Medical School, I believe. And the defendants in the two cases are OHSU, the hospital, and Dr. Jason Campbell, who is the person who sexually harassed and abused the plaintiff in a very serious manner. He has since been dismissed from Oregon, is somewhere else. But in her civil lawsuit for damages that she has filed against Dr. Campbell and Oregon State, she makes allegations in the text of her complaint against another physician at OHSU, Dr. Esther Chu. Dr. Chu is one of the founders of Time's Up Healthcare. She's one of a large group of women that spontaneously, after the Golden Globes moment in 2018, came together in healthcare and said, we want to address these issues in the healthcare system. Wow. And came together as a group of volunteers. And those are the founders that are listed on the website. There was a volunteer group of steering committee folks who've been helping to do some of that work. We did have a paid, a public health official as our paid staff person for the last year. But they were, a volunteer group who we highly regard. And there, many of them have been doing amazing work for all of us, because a lot of them are emergency room physicians, or specialists in COVID. They have all been putting their lives on the line for the last year. So, which is why when some people...
So why all the resignations though?
Well, so Dr. Chu is alleged in the complaint of not supporting the plaintiff. There's certain allegations about what Dr. Chu said to the plaintiff. Dr. Chu has a very different version. She's now made her own public statement where she said the plaintiff was a friend of hers. She tried at all times to be supportive. Mm-hmm. The folks who've resigned wanted us to remove Dr. Chu or have Dr. Chu resign from, she's on our governing board, and from Time's Up Healthcare. And we were not going to ask her to resign. She's not the defendant. She's not the perpetrator here. She was handling at what Dr. Chu says was in a way that she thought was 100% support of the survivor. The survivor didn't see it that way, which, I am sorry. We want to set her the survivor and we want to make sure we are supportive of her. I do not believe that supporting the survivor means that you also turn your back on someone who has worked hard to change a troubled institution. Mm-hmm. The easy thing to do might be to walk away from anybody who has anything to do with a troubled institution. I think you need to stand with folks who are trying to make change from the inside, even if there may be disagreements about, trauma when sexual abuse happens is really hard, and it's not always a clear path on what you do when you're advising and counseling a survivor. And other people may disagree with the way Dr. Chu handled it, but it's not clear that she did anything wrong in what she did. We're not the litigators of that. She's not even the focus of what will ultimately come out in the case, because she's not a defendant. And so
you're continuing to stand by Dr. Chu.
We've stood by her. I've released a long statement explaining that you can both stand with the survivor and you can continue to stand with people who are trying to make change
And how are you addressing the people who've resigned? I mean, do you want them to come back?
We would always welcome them to come back, Sharon.
But what is the message that you're drawing from that?
Well, I'm drawing from it is that these kinds of cases are hard. And they are difficult, and there is not always a clear path on how to navigate them. And there can be disagreements among people of good faith of how to handle it. We happen to disagree with some of the resigners on how, what their view of what Dr. Chu should have said in their statement, and now their view of what we should have done in response. I feel very comfortable in having stood with someone who's been a champion for women, who has some facts that are in conflict about how she handled, you know, this survivor's case. Mm-hmm. I think that you can do to both things. You can stand with the survivor, which we absolutely do. She was clearly wronged by Dr. Campbell, and we support her, you know, in her case. And mm-hmm. I don't think that means we need to walk away from Dr. Chu and her work.
Well, I think that we found that it's a very complex maze that we navigate in today's culture, Me Too culture, woke culture, and what we talk a lot about cancel culture and what that is. And it's not always easy to know what the right thing is to do. It's always hard to do the right thing, but sometimes it's now even hard to know what the right thing to do is.
It is. But that's why. And look, anyone who left over this, and we always share goals on what we're trying to change and the change we're trying to make, you know, in this world, and you know, welcome and stand with anyone always. So I respect the decisions. I'm saddened by them, but I respect them, and I would respect anyone who wants to work with us again in the future. Mm.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Tina Chen, the CEO and the president of Time's Up. Thank you for sharing your views and giving us your time. And we will see what happens with the Golden Globes. That will be a very, very interesting story that we will be following this year. Take care, and thanks for coming to the wrap up.
No, of course. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap Up. Thank you to all our listeners, and remember to please follow us or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.